Hi, dear movie breakers, and welcome to our seventh festival podcast that we are doing now. Patrick, as you know, has already left for home. He could just stay for about a week, but the festival, of course, it goes 10 days. So I give you another podcast. And so that you don't have just to listen to my voice, I have here a guest. It's Xavier. Hi, Xavier. It's so good to have you.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me. So hi, everyone. My name is Xavier. I am the founder and editor-in-chief of A Room of Their Own, and I'm a staff reporter at Naiguan Film. I'm originally from China, and I'm currently based in LA, and this is my first Sundance, and I'm excited to be a part of this conversation.
So we are basically both Sundance newbies. You know, it's my second festival. How do you experience it so far? Because the bigger part of the festival has been over.
I feel like the festival has been overall pretty chill. Everyone has been pretty friendly. They're willing to talk about their experiences, what they do. The community events here are very vibrant. You can go to a coffee shop and see people talking about business, or you spot a director. Yesterday, I was at Atika's, which is one of the most famous coffee shop on Main Street here, and I saw James Wang just right there and just sitting there. So,
He had today a talk at Cinema Cafe, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. Yeah, and yesterday he was just chilling and drinking a coffee there. And I like this community. I actually just talked about this with another journalist this morning when we talked about how exclusive some of the European festival could be, and Sundance feels a little bit more like down to earth and grounded. And it's good to be, you know, in the snow again, because, you know, I'm based in California and it's always hot, and it's good to have a little bit of a shift. Yeah.
Yeah, that's, of course, also related to the fact that the town itself, Park City, it's so small, it's so central. So even if some of the stars would want to escape, they couldn't.
Yeah.
And in many of the European festival cities, it's just, as you said, much more secluded. Stars are in separate hotels and separate areas, and you never really see them engage with people. Even though there, of course, are those hierarchies, you know. At one of our podcasts in the past, we talked about red badges. Did you have any special experiences with red badges?
Yes. I think one of the few encounters I'm like, whoa, is like when I was at the press and industry screenings, because, you know, I'm on a working press, which is, I would say, the lowest tier of the press pass here. And then we are only let into the P&I screenings like 5 minutes before the showtime. And then the prestigious rep passes, they are able to go in like whenever they want. And it happens a couple of times at premieres as well, where, you know, I'm on a wait list and we were supposed to have seats, but pass holders showed up and then we have to give up on that.
And because we mentioned in a previous podcast that it's money that gets you a red pass, but just to give you an idea how much money, so $25,000 donation per year. So every year you have to give at least $25,000 and you get a red pass. To give you a few insights about that, you see how Sundance is. But today you brought us one film that I have already seen, and I said a few things about it, but you also found it, I think, pretty impressive. That is Wicker.
Yes. So yeah, Wicker is probably one of my favorites that I've seen at Sundance so far. I've seen overall 17 films so far at Sundance. And I think Wicker is just very unique because it's almost straight out of a literature book. And it's very complete in that way. It obviously it has chapters, and it is adapted from a short story. But I think what I find fascinating is that they moved the traditional structure of like a short story or a piece of literature straight on on screen. So we have a very well-rounded world building from the start. And then everyone in the film is like named after their occupations. So we have like Fisherwoman, who's the main leading character, and then we have basket maker and boots maker, or like the doctor. You're named after your like occupation in that way, and obviously setting in mid-century. And I'm just very drawn by the setting of it, but also the story. It's the main character played by the amazing Olivia Colman. She's my favorite actress of all time, so maybe I'm biased, but she is just stunning in the film, playing this woman who's misunderstood by the town and chasing after her career fear and then also her desire and want. Very multidimensional characters. And for other like supporting roles, especially the ones played by her daughter-in-law in The Crown, which is Elizabeth, her character is like also very interesting and very multidimensional. That's why I liked a lot about this film, is because it has different layers to each characters. And
it has also these aspects of a social metaphor, especially this what you mentioned, that every character doesn't have an individual name, but it's named after their profession. So even if this profession is somewhat privileged, the characters cannot escape that definition, and they're only seen as this specific role they play in society. And of course, the fantastic makeup and special effects.
Yeah, I've heard talks about how it's gonna be up for best makeup and hairstyling at the Oscar for sure in The Game, because, you know, literally building a man out of wicker. And I was at the Q&A and they mentioned how it's like a lot of them are practical, and I think it's not just a hair makeup sound. Like, I think putting that kind of image on screen, it takes work from all departments. Obviously, the actor needs to be wearing these things and prosthetics and the makeup team, the hair team. And also in post, they talked about how they use like a certain Foley to make the very specific sound of how the Wicker Man moves. And then
the sound changes over the film. You know, at first he's louder, like a wicker basket. It makes more sounds when it's new, and when it's used, the wood is softer and makes less noise.
Yes, yes, that's impressive to me. They also mentioned something about the score that kind of accompanied that, but I can't quite remember. But like just details like that, that makes this film very outstanding.
Even though it's a glossy mainstream movie, it has a lot of depth to it and a lot of interesting aspects. For example, this element that they try to buy happiness, because the fisherwoman, she goes to the basket maker and pays him to make her a wicker husband. And later we have another woman pay the basket maker to make her a wicker baby. Mm-hmm. So people literally pay to achieve a certain form of happiness or fulfillment. And the film poses the question, can you buy happiness? And then it's not as, I would say, the film is luckily not so illusion to say you cannot buy happiness, because money definitely helps you to achieve it, but right, money won't get you until the end. You have to do some work.
So yeah.
That's a good compromise.
Yes, that's an interesting, and I think that compromise comes in the characterization as well, because I was thinking about all those classic literature, and it has this woman who's misunderstood by the people in a small town, because, you know, she's childless, she's husbandless, you know.
It's like a Love, Samuel Hawthorne. And
yeah,
kind of.
It has I won't spoil it, but there's a very specific way that people would call a woman without a husband, or when a woman gets married in the film. But so I was thinking about that, and then it's, a lot of the times are portrayed as someone who doesn't have that desire just altogether, because, you know, maybe they find empowerment in like being alone and being focused on their careers, obviously. And but sometimes I feel like a lot of times they're portrayed as someone who doesn't have a like sexual desire, or doesn't have like an ambition in terms of romance and all of that in their characterization. And I think in Olivia Colman's character, she still has that. And then I think she is very explicitly expressed on screen. Like there's a lot of sex.
It's very bawdy. It's also reminiscent of Chaucer and the Canterbury Tales. Very, very bawdy. And it is for adults, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's a great compromise, because, you know, we have, obviously her character has this anatomy over herself and her life that's asserted very early on from the film, because she doesn't really care what anyone say. But also at the same time, she has the desire for romance. You know, she still wants those things, and that's what makes her human. And I feel like having these two facets of her character makes her feel very alive.
Yeah, so thank you for this great input. So The Wicker Man, we already mentioned it to you, but here you have now another perspective with a lot of depth, and then I can assume it's a recommendation from you for this film?
Oh yes, absolutely. Yeah, like as I said, it's one of the top ones I've seen so far at the festival.
Yeah, great. So then let's move on to a title that we both have seen, and this is one of the documentaries from a director who had her big breakout at this festival with another documentary documentary. It's like about 4 years ago that Sarah Dosa had her fire of love at Sundance, and now she's back with Time and Water. You have seen this as well. Would you like to talk a little bit about what this film is about?
Yes. So this film is almost like completely different subject matter of Fire of Love. We are exploring glaciers instead of volcano this time. Personal story of an Icelandic family and their relationship with the glaciers, having it being on the verge of diminishing suddenly, and then the story that kind of follows that.
From the perspective of the Icelandic writer Andri Snær Magnason, and he's tasked with writing an eulogy for one of the glaciers that's about to disappear or loses its status as a glacier. Snow is melting and the ice is melting. And now he's faced with this very real fear of losing something that was just given to him, and also the home of his children, the memories of his parents. So loss, family, in the context of nature, that's a huge theme in the film. Have you seen Fire of Love back then?
Yes, and I'm surprised a lot of people haven't. You know, when I was talking to people about, oh, you should go see Time and Water, and then they're like, oh, what is this? And then I was like, oh, that's the director who made Fire of Love, who was, I believe, kind of a big film back in the day.
And then absolutely, it was Oscar nominated and everything. So
I was surprised that a lot of people were like, oh, I didn't know what that was. And so I'm like, okay, cool, because Time and Water, I think it does take a different approach, although a similar style, but a different approach. I feel like it's grander in scale. I think Fire of Love was still very focused on these two couples and their very, very specific memories and stories. But I feel like Time and Water, it tries to be grander and kind of relates to everyone who's Icelandic, first of all, and everyone who's had a shared memories of glaciers being around them, because glaciers and
just of snow, really. I mean, it doesn't even have to be a glacier. I think we all noticed that the snow is disappearing, even here in Park City.
Oh, yes. Because, you know, this year, the locals, they all say the snows are melting. It's the worst year for skiing in a long time. And I feel like it's such a unique and special time for this film to debut in Sundance.
Yeah, to me, it was also very interesting that while Fire of Love had this thriller-like or criminalistic story of this couple, which then got killed by a volcano eruption. So it's a kind of spectacular way to go. And here we have the counter image of a very slow, subtle death that's so slow and subtle that some people deny that it's even happening. You know, that there's a lot of climate change denial happening. Even though the film doesn't directly address this, you have to think about it. So I think that's also the great craft of this director, that she brings up certain subjects without pointing her finger at it, but you still feel it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think the difference between the two films is that in Fire of Love, it's like the protagonists are really much on the same beat and pulse of the volcano. So the volcano is very active and involved in their relationships. But in terms of Time and Water, I feel like this protagonist and the people that are talked about in the story, they take the glaciers as more of a granted object. They're like, the glaciers are sort of serve as this quiet witness of the history of the country, or like the family history of the protagonist. So it's more passive in that way. And I feel like having that like difference is really interesting.
Yeah, so I totally agree. And also, of course, the fantastic images we have. We have both archive images from the past, from the personal archives of this writer, Magnussen, who is the center of the film, together with his parents and his kids. And then we have contemporary images that she takes. Even those images compared allow us to really see how the ice is disappearing and how the glaciers are melting.
When I was talking about how grand this film is, I was also talking about how grand the wide range of visual materials that they had. You know, we went from this like water museum to photo of a wedding of the protagonist's grandparents. It's all over the place, and it's like condensed in this one film that surrounds the same subject. I would say that you would definitely not get bored by this film just because of the visual capacity that it has. And that's exactly the reason why it's so kind of precious in a way.
Yeah, it's also very engaging. I think once you're in the story, you really can't let go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it's personal, like it was for Fire of Love. She likes to explore this personal narrative that has a tie to a bigger issue.
Thank you very much. And I think we both can absolutely recommend this film. Yeah, so look out for it. I'm sure it will get a European release or a German release, and hopefully also in the US, not just streaming.
Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, what else have you in terms of films for us?
So this one's really close to Wicker in my list, but Burn by the auteur, Japanese director. He is just breaking another boundaries of visual and of storytelling at his new work, Burn, which is about these marginalized runaways in modern Japan on the streets. I feel like this subject matter, just first of all, the subject matter hit really close to home because I personally know people like that on the streets of, it's not just a Japanese thing. It might be originating from Japan, but the culture is all over East Asia. I personally know people who are like that, who suffer from family trauma, suffer from violence, suffer from sexual assault, like many of those very traumatic things in their life. And they come together as a community to cope. But what I love about the film is that they did not choose to portray these group of people as this angelic, utopia kind of community. They're kind of evil in some way, you know, like, because you would expect, like, you know, a bunch of troubled teens together, you know, they build a chosen family. That's how a lot of the narrative.
Peter Pan fantasy.
Yes. Yeah, that's a lot of narratives, like, they do it. But I was really surprised to see that he portrayed these people as kind of selfish and kind of, you know, evil in some ways, you know.
But that strikes me as very realistic, because if you live on the street, you have to be selfish to a degree, and you have to be distrustful. That's mm-hmm. just like a survival strategy.
Yes. So that's why I was going to mention the authenticity that comes through that. Although it's not, because I personally love optimistic film. I love positive films. I feel like we need that. But I feel like for him to decide to put this, like to do this decision in this film, it's very particular. And I feel like an authenticity shines through that. Although I will say, at one point, the protagonist becomes too sad, like quote unquote too sad for the audience, that some of the audience actually left the premiere because of the set reason, and they gave the film a low score on Letterboxd because it's like, oh, this is too sad, I can't watch. And I feel like, what does that say about the film in terms of making people feel uncomfortable? Like, is it something that we should appreciate, or is it something that we should be careful for? I think that's a really good question to ask yourself. Like, would you rather stay in your comfort zone by watching this, like this film that's like super uplifting and happy, or you want to explore, you know, give yourself a space to be troubled? Like, what does that mean? And what does that, like, help you in becoming a person? And so I think that's a question that Burn definitely posts in its cinema language.
What did you think of the visuals?
I think he is one of the best told directors in modern day that always push boundaries through visuals. It's just like, there are visuals that I've never seen in any other films in this one. And we have like this PVC kind of like plastic heaven, like video games heaven. And then we have video game-ish like flame simulation in the film. And then a lot of like extreme first person point of view shots, which is one of the shots I really love about this film, because there's a metaphor in the film that's like, these people are cockroaches. And it shows through the visual, because a lot of the times the camera is on the very low ground staring up. And I feel like that's just an amazing and bold decision that also embodies the message of the film. I was in awe with all the visual choices in the film, and that almost made up of some of the narrative choices that I had to think about more. It's one of those things where if I like a film more, I would look at its disadvantages and flaws more. You know, that's what I do, you know, for like films like Hot Water, for example. I found myself trying to find the good parts of it. And that means maybe it's not so good for me, you know, and
that's an interesting perspective as a film critic, you know, that because many people are like, oh, if I love a film, I'm more likely to overlook everything that's bad. But you then put your eyes on it.
Mm-hmm. Yes. It's just something I discover about myself when I'm like talking about a film that I really like. Actually, I focus more on its flaws because I think that's my way of being like, oh, how could they make this like perfect? So yeah, that's what I feel about Burn. It's like there are a lot of choices in the film that are still questionable, but I feel like overall it portrayed in this like uncomfortably realistic and authentic way. And I feel like it's up to you to decide if that works for you.
Definitely sounds something encouraging to check this film out and then make this decision. I'm going to also tell you about another film. And since I really like documentary and it's one of my main focus, I have another documentary for you, especially since this festival is famous for its documentary slates, both World Documentary Competition and US Documentary Competition. And then there's the premiere section, which has even more documentaries.
Yes.
And this is actually one documentary from the premiere section, The Attempted Murder of Salman Rushdie. And it's directed by Alex Gibney. He had big documentaries here like Enron, The Smartest Guy in the Room. He recently made a documentary about Elon Musk that's not out yet. Or films like Citizen K. So Gibney is very well known for his critical, socially urgent documentaries. And as the title says, this one deals with the 2022 knife stabbing attack on Indian-born British writer Salman Rushdie, the guy who wrote the Satanic Verses. Everybody knows that. And even though you say, no, well, but all the excitement, all the outrage about the Satanic Verses, that's like a decade ago, if not more. And you're right. And this is why it's so surprising that there was suddenly 2022 this assassination of him. I mean, did you remember it in the news?
No, yes, I did. Yeah, it was just shocking. Yeah.
Yeah, the footage was everywhere. And we actually do see the footage, even the parts of the footage that so far had not been released, because you could often see just snippets where the assassin, Hadi Matar, where he ran towards Rushdie. And then you see some brawl on the ground, but you could not really see the knife going down on Rushdie. And we finally now, Rushdie has released those footage and allowed it to be seen. So it's really shocking to see it, but also the images of him in the hospital just after the attack. He decided he wants to document all the violence, also in case he would not survive this attack. Because sometimes even if you go through the first operation, you can still die on later consequences of the assassination. He lost, he didn't lose his eye, but he got blind in one eye from the attack. His throat was stabbed. One of his hands is almost unusable because all the tendons and nerves were severed by the knife. So it's really a wonder that he's still alive. And he reflects on this impact of this assassination on him personally, because the film, the documentary, is based in his own writings. He wrote a book that's called Knife, the Meditations on an Assassination of Salman Rushdie. That's by Rushdie himself. And also on this whole campaign of hate against Rushdie after the Satanic Verses came out, and the reflection on the implications of free speech. Because if a country like the UK says, if Ayatollah Khomeini threatens us, we will pull books from the shelves, that says a lot about how much free speech we actually have.
I think that's such an interesting, again, like very timely in a way, you know, political violence and violence surrounding free speech is, I think, more prevalent than in the US and any other countries. And to have this kind of foreshadowing happening from another case that's in a different situation and context is just an interesting parallel, especially the time that we're living in right now, where like people always try to seek an alternative way to seek justice. And for many reasons, it's almost understandable in the world that we're living in right now and here in the US, like atrocities happen, to kind of balance that within our heart, to know what's truly the right thing to do is, I guess, all we can do right now in this time, and where divisions and hard decisions needs to be made.
Very true. And it's also interesting if you hear specific interviews in this film when people say things like, oh, I'm totally in favor of free speech, unless it's against religion. So there's always this kind of, I totally support that, but. and this idea, like the limitations of freedom and free speech, but also the question, how can you feel safe in this social climate of possible assassination and vigilantism? You know, if you have always this, I mean, there are, if you look back, we can remember many cases of people, both people we might hate as conservative figures or figures like artists like Rushdie who got assassinated. And that you really have this idea that law and order are shifting and that assassination is just something that can happen like that.
So
pretty scary.
It is scary, yeah, for sure. And I just going off of that, I feel like people are always selfish and you have to realize that. And I feel like to have this collective conscious of what's right, like the right thing to do, it's a question that humans have been asking themselves throughout history. And I think we are standing at a very historical time right now, you know, like both for Sundance and for just the overall climate of the global politics. I feel like this area like will definitely go down in history. I was just talking about about this with someone. It's like so much political division and so much hatred. And
I also often think it's like the McCarthy era, you know, that we just have these oppressive forces and these things happening and we take them for granted and just accept them. And we get always told, oh, it's all for our safety. But where is that safety? Everything is getting unsafe on every level constantly.
Yeah. And that just on a personal level, I mean, I'm here. I've been here on a visa as an international student since I was in high school. And I personally know how difficult the process is for you to be accepted, quote unquote, as a citizen of the United States. And the process is long and it's hard. And I've been here since I was a sophomore in high school. And I'm still like quite like if every logistics goes right, I still have a couple more years to go until I could even reach that status. And that's, you know, if I have all the documents, all the procedures done right. But to live in this country in this time is very special. Like, I think I've come across necessarily, I would not say that I feel safe expressing my opinions online or in person in any way. Like, what will actually happen if I just speak my mind? Like, will that consequence outweigh the impact I make by speaking up? And I think I've already gone through the anxious phase and I feel like I'm getting more comfortable speaking up about my opinions because I think it's a historical time. And I think, although I'm in a disadvantaged position and privileged people should speak up more, I think I want to be able to be in like a person in the room to bring hard questions up, to know that what takes a person to speak up their mind is a way that we can push free speech to the place that we want it to be.
Though I'm very privileged as a European citizen, usually getting a visa somewhere is no problem. You can always walk the fast line on the airport and all that. But even I feel intimidated about what can I say online or even just on WhatsApp, you know, not even posting it somewhere on Instagram or TikTok, but just writing a WhatsApp message because they check the WhatsApp handles on the airport, immigration and customs. And then I'm really scared, like if I just say the wrong thing about Trump or crack some stupid joke, will they just say like, no, you don't get into the US? Because even if you have a visa approved, that doesn't mean they have you to let you in. They can just send you back for no reason at all.
Mm-hmm.
So that is something. And of course, in my own writing as a movie critic and journalist, I'm constantly confronted with this idea. Why do we have to make everything political? Why do we have to put social questions in there? Can you not just like a film? Can you not just feel like entertained? I think that it doesn't matter if we are film writers or literature writers or whatever, that there's always a political and social issues that have to be addressed, you know, that everything is political and we have to use our voices. Like, I think that's very, very good point.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
But now to get back to the festival, I want to ask, are there some smaller films that you like to point out? And are there some films that you're looking forward to?
Trying to go to a lot of the ones that are like more in the premiere section because we are emerging platforms and writing reviews for you know, bigger films get us more exposure. That's just what it is. You know, obviously Sundance accepts a lot of debut feature, and there's a lot of debut features in the competitions. You can tell a lot of the times when a feature is debut work for Sundance to like appreciate them in that way, and putting an audience and a platform for these artists, it's amazing. Like, for example, I would say Bedford Park is an interesting example because it talks about the bonds between these two Asian American immigrant young adults. It's made obviously by an Asian American filmmaker, and although that some of the approaches are still stereotypical, it has a new definition of the new age Asian American immigrants, because the guy of one of the two main characters, he's had one of the most complex and special portray of Asian American male characters that I've seen in a long time. He is a ex-wrestler. He has a past that he leaves behind him. He has a debt, but he's trying to become a great person by, you know, going to college and all of that. I feel like I've never seen, and he's also very like emotionally available. And I feel like I've never seen that kind of an Asian male character before. I think that's the power of, you know, bringing new features, new filmmakers into festivals like this.
I have this film saved on my online slate, since we can watch a certain number of films, or actually an unlimited number of films we can watch online from the competition and sections as much as is possible in 3 days, because the online window is only 3 days.
Yep.
Theoretically, you can watch all the films that are online, but in reality, of course, maybe 10 or 12 films is realistic. I have one film that is, well, from the Duplass brothers, and I just like quickly to mention it, from Jay Duplass. You know, he has his brother Mark. Sometimes they work together, sometimes they work solo. And he had also like a long-standing relationship with Sundance Film Festival. And now he's here with his new film, See You When I See You, which is a tragic comedy. I think it doesn't really have famous actors in it. David Duchovny is the most well-known member of the cast, but even Duchovny is not like a big A-level star. We mostly know him from TV, and if you're a little bit older than me, you know him from The X-Files still. And this film addresses, in a very whimsical way, it addresses suicide. You know, the main character is a man in his late 20s, and he has to deal with the suicide of his younger sister, to whom he had like a very, very close personal relationship. The film is just in this phase before they have the actual funeral, and a few weeks after they have gone through all those basic procedures that you have to go through if somebody dies, declare them legally dead, and all those things. It's basically about him struggling emotionally and accepting that he has PTSD just from the fact that he actually was the person who found his sister dead, and that he just can't cope with this pain. I think it's great that the film addresses suicide. I think it's also great that this film does not condemn suicide or judge about it. It just accepts it as something that has happened, just like an accident or an illness. Actually, there's even in a comparison with illness that the film says, okay, sometimes it happens that people end their life. On the other hand, there is this idea in this film, oh, if you are struggling with trauma or some experience like that, you have to go to therapy and then it will be better. That's very simplistic, because sometimes therapy just doesn't help. Sometimes therapy makes things worse, and this isn't really addressed. And we have even this parallel that we have one character in the film struggling with what's very likely a cancer diagnosis, and then the other character is struggling with this PTSD depression, and both are aligned, and there's this idea, you get chemo or you get psychotherapy and then you will be better. That's a double whammy. Chemo often doesn't help. Often cancer comes back. After chemo, you die anyway. And there are even many people who say like chemo is worse than cancer, and they prefer to have cancer when a few bearable years of life, even because therapy often just can't help you. And even if it can help you to cope with certain outer signs of trauma, can it really heal you inside?
Films like that, I big no-no for films that address suicide to try to provide a solution. I feel like the audience, yeah, they would love to see you be like, oh, it's a miracle or something like that, but that's not real life. You know, like in real life, suicide is caused by so many different reasons, and you don't try to find a solution for it. And a lot of the times, there's only so much you can do. So to put yourself in the responsibility of like, oh, I can do this so I can magically save my close friend's depressed mind is not fair to them or to you. So I feel like a good thing about these kind of films is just, like you said, not address it or define it at the beginning as anything good or bad. Just sort of present it as it is and don't like try to go out of your way to like find a solution for it, because a lot of the times the people who committed suicide probably tried those solutions. They
exactly. It's a very good point. Yeah, that you even ask, why then would anybody kill themselves if you just have to go to therapy and it will work?
And it's like a lot of times they were the ones who understand it. And for the people who are still here that still get to talk about it, it's really not our place to judge them in any way or to even try to provide any solutions or definitions of the tragedy, because it's just what it is.
Yeah. And then there's even the sort of psychotherapy, because the basic idea is that the psychotherapist tells this young man who struggles with PTSD, oh, if this trauma comes up, just think of something positive and go to your happy place. And they literally call it happy place. This is just repression. This is like, if negative feelings bubble up, just think of something good. That's textbook repression, you know? I mean, that could be a short-term solution, but it can never be a long-term solution, you know? Always to just be like, oh, I don't want to think about it, because at some point you have to just confront what has happened. Unfortunately, I cannot really recommend this film. Like, if you are a diehard fan of the Duplass brothers or of Jay Duplass, yeah, if you have a preference for one of the brothers, by all means, watch it. It's well acted. It has some funny jokes. I have to admit that. But for me, it just didn't strike a chord. Now we come to the end of our podcast. Thank you for having been here. Is there anything specific that you would like to add or say? Anything that struck you about your first Sundance?
I feel like we are at a very special, I was very lucky to be involved in such a unique year for Sundance, like leaving its legacy at Park City and able to go to some legacy screenings as well as just that Mysterious Skin last year. An end of an era in a way, but I feel what doesn't stop is obviously Sundance's mission to cultivate emerging independent filmmakers. But also, I have to tie it back to the time that we're living in right now. I feel like to go to films that address difficult issues and hard questions is how we could contribute our parts to this ongoing political nightmare that's hopefully going to be resolved later in the year. But cinema and its power is always something that I personally go to. And I feel like at this time, Sundance departure reminds us that we should believe in the power of cinema and we should go watch films, go make films. That's the artist's way of resisting. It's a beautiful way to do that.
I definitely can agree on we should watch films and we should make films 100%. I think it's very interesting for me to see that you have a very positive view of Sundance after your first experience, because I remember last year when it was my first Sundance, I also had this very positive view, and this year I've got a bit more down to earth. So I'm curious and excited to see, hope to see you next year in Boulder, you know, Sundance is moving to Boulder, and then to see if your view has changed or if it has been reaffirmed.
Yeah.
So thank you so much for joining
Absolutely.
Us here on the podcast.
Thank you so much. And thank you guys for listening.
There will be one more podcast, but until then, we say goodbye, folks.